This is Marcy Hume, and I am the director and producer of a film called Magicians, subtitle Life in the Impossible, and you probably know why it has that subtitle. And it is a documentary that follows four magicians who are making a living at the art form that we all know and love.
This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's podcast is brought to you by the Great American Magic Company.com, an online magic store where you should go to purchase your products. Whether it's a physical product or an automatic download, be sure and check out the Great American Magic Company.com. And speaking of shopping, you can help support the MagicWordPodcast.com by making your Amazon.com purchases through the link that is provided here on the podcast. If you'll go to our blog at themagicwordpodcast.com and go over to the Amazon affiliate store, there'll be a link there where you can click and then you will go directly to your Amazon account. If you have a Premier account or even if you don't, that you can still purchase and your account will open automatically if you're already signed in. And any purchase that you make, that a contribution is made by Amazon to the Magic Word Podcast. And we thank you very much for that. And for that matter, if you're wanting to make an additional donation of any type or of any size from $1 on up, whether it's going to be a one-time donation or if it's going to be an ongoing monthly pledge, then please join the Friends of the Magic Word. They're again at the blog at themagicwordpodcast.com. There's a place where you can become a friend of the Magic Word. And you can learn all about how that you can help support us and keep this podcast free for the world to enjoy. And be sure to follow us on facebook.com/themagicwordpodcast and on Twitter at magicwordpod and Instagram at scottwellsmagic. There are different ways that you can keep up with us and share the magic. And for that matter, you can spread the word if you just help to tell others about the Magic Word Podcast. And be sure to subscribe on not only your iTunes. If you are an Android user, there's a way of doing that as well. If you go over again to the magicwordpodcast.com website, there is a place there where you can subscribe and you can do that very easily and never miss another podcast. Well, this week we're going to have a very interesting guest, someone who actually is different from what I have had in the past. In particular, not only is this person a magician, but it is a woman, and I don't have a lot of females, it seems like, that I have had the opportunity to interview or chat with, I should say, on this program. And I also find that what is making this the most interesting is not only does she do magic, but in particular, she does mentalism, and there are not a lot of women who do mentalism as well. But besides that, the reason we're chatting with Marcy Hume this week is because she is the producer and director of the movie which was recently released. It's actually a documentary, and the documentary is called Magicians, Life in the Impossible. And she is actually just one of the two producers and directors who put this documentary together. And again, Marcy Hume is our guest, but the other director and producer was Christoph Baden. And he is not the magician or mentalist between the two of them. So that's the reason that Marcy had a good background and some interest in talking to us here on The Magic Word about this. And so again, this was something that was released in late 2016 and has been seen at documentary film festival, I believe it's called Hot Docs, Docs for Documentary, and was just recently, as we're going to broadcast on this, just recently, like within this past week, released onto Netflix. So it's on a streaming media that you can now view through Netflix. It is, of course, also available through their website, which I would recommend that you go and help support them, which is Magicians Movie, and magiciansmovie.com, and you can get more information on it there. You can also see a trailer, which I have on the website at the Magic Word Podcast. Or if you go to their website, you can see a trailer as well as learn more information about the people who were in this movie. The four people who they followed included John Armstrong, David Menken, Jan Rubin, and Brian Gillis. And so it was an interesting perspective from the standpoint that it's not just one type of magic, but it was some mentalist close-up and as well as stage illusionists and everything. So it's just, again, a different kind of a perspective of people who had different dreams and different goals, but all had the same path. That is, all trying to follow magic in order to reach and achieve those dreams. So I'm going to step out of the way over here and introduce our guest for the day, Miss Marcy Hume, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for TheMagicWordPodcast.com, and it gives me great pleasure to speak with the producer and director of The Magicians, a new documentary that has come out. So hello there, Marcy. How are you?
Hello there, Scott. I'm great. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to actually meet you, as we started talking early before we got online here, to meet you virtually. And I understand just from our correspondence we've had back and forth regarding this movie that actually there were two directors of this movie. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So okay. Myself and Christoph Baden, who I've made another feature documentary with, and he was the sort of non-magic person in the directing duo, which actually came in very handy in certain instances.
Oh, that's good. So you kind of get a real person's layman's response, I guess, kind of a thing. Is that
exactly.
Right? Yeah, okay.
Exactly. That's what I always say. He was the real person.
The real
magic
person. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But you have a magic background. So tell me a little bit about how that you got magic, or what was... your inspiration.
I do, yeah. I had a few things that were sort of the catalyst, but it was about 10 years ago and it just happened to me sort of overnight. I saw a couple of effects that just completely blew me away. They were mentalism effects, and I just, it was like a switch, and I just couldn't stop investigating magic and thinking about magic. And I for a long time actually studied it by myself and didn't really have a lot of guidance. I had a couple of friends that I reached out to who recommended some books for me. So I mm-hmm. spent the first few years in magic just really thinking about what really the kind of bigger picture of what I thought magic was and what it could do for people, what these, you know, I especially love mentalism. So kind of what that dynamic was and what we're actually doing with people in that scenario. And then I started, you know, becoming a little bit more involved in the magic community, which I think has its positives and negatives, but started kind of broadening, you know, my research, I guess, a little bit in that way. I perform very intermittently, but I notice a lot of the times that there will be these young, you know, teenage boys who are, you know, hanging out around magic and, you know, they've bought some gimmicks and they're yeah. performing a little bit and they'll call themselves a magician. And they thought, well, heck, if I'm performing, you know, non-professionally, but I've been studying this for 10 years and really obsessed with it, and I do perform, I'm going to also call myself a magician because I certainly have more to give than, you know, a kid with a gimmick. So that's where I've landed.
You really can't call yourself a magician until you get your business cards printed. You know, it takes few days for those to get printed, you know, and so then you're official. You know?
Exactly. That's what makes it or breaks it. Exactly. You got it.
Right. Right. Well, I'm always fascinated to find out about how that women get involved because there are obviously, as you know, so few that are in magic, and particularly that you are in mentalism. You know, Alison Campbell, a friend of mine in Las Vegas, is one of the only other female magicians that I personally know. I'm sure there are many others, but she's one that comes to mind. But I assume in talking about some of the books and things, you have Psychological Subtleties of Vanacek's?
I actually have that with me right now on this trip for some reason. It's sitting right in front of me as we speak. I just sometimes carry certain books around to refresh my memory. So, yes.
Good. Well, you see my name inside there because I was the person who had edited and put that together, that I'm Vanacek's business partner there.
And I love that. Yeah. Look, Scott, I've seen pictures of you with a bunch of my buddies. So we're 1 degree away from each other, but we've never met. So there we go.
I feel as if that I should know you. Now, when you perform, do you live in the Los Angeles area?
I do live in Los Angeles, yes. Mm-hmm.
So you get to the castle frequently? I assume that you're a member of the academy?
I do, yeah. And I you know, I had a friend tell me, he said, you know, you really, you know, I love the castle so much. And when I found the castle, it was this moment where I realized that there was a place where I could talk about magic as much as I wanted to, which mm-hmm. for me was, you know, at the time when I got into magic, I was living in London and, there just wasn't a kind of format for me to be talking about magic all the time. And I was working in television and my TV buddies thought I was a little bit nuts to be so obsessed with it. And so when I found the Magic Castle, I just thought it was this gold mine, this sort of treasure where I yeah. could talk about it all the time. But a friend of mine recently said, you know, you really should just spend more time performing now. Like you've really, you know, you've been reading a lot and you chat with people about your ideas, but you just don't perform enough. You have to, you know, just do more and more. So I think I'm going to turn the dial now and start focusing a little
bit
more on
that.
That's
right. Magic is a performing art, you know.
Exactly.
I always say a magician who's not working is only fooling himself. you know. So
I think that might be me a little bit. When I perform, every time I perform still, I'm still in the phase where, you know, I learned some new profound lesson. And so that, you know, I always knew I always felt very, very early on in my kind of journey with magic. But mm-hmm. I think even now I'm still pretty early on because I still change my mind about things. I still have these profound moments and realizations when I perform. So, there's a lot to go.
I'm surprised when you lived in London that you hadn't found the Magic Circle, because there's obviously a big community of magicians there. And I don't say fraternity, because many years ago that was open to women, and there are several women who are very good who work performing there at the Magic Circle. Have you visited the circle? Or
I did. I went once, and, you know, for whatever reason, I don't know if it was the night I was there, but I found it kind of depressing. Ah. I just, okay. I didn't connect with anyone, and it didn't kind of, you know, I was there to kind of connect and chat with people, and it didn't work out for me. So I didn't pursue it again. But, you know, I think, you know, I don't want to make our whole conversation about women in magic, but there is obviously, you know, that is a huge component of this that, you know, at certain times, obviously you can kind of ignore and not, it doesn't matter and it's inconsequential, but there are times when I do think it matters. And I think it can be an interesting thing, and at times it can even be a tool, you know, it can be a sort of positive part of performing. But yeah, I do think, you know, socially sometimes it can be a little bit bizarre. I mean, you know, I was talking to a magician here in Portland who's a woman, and she said, so do you have the same thing if you go to a meeting or a convention or anything, they say, oh, so whose girlfriend are you?
And yeah. It's like, well, I'm the magician.
Yeah. Yeah, it's ubiquitous. You will get that question 10 times. Somebody will say, like, oh, is your boyfriend a magician? It's just constant. So
I think that's it goes across some other professions as well. Let's say like a doctor.
Definitely.
You know, you assume that someone is a male doctor, and then when a woman walks in, it's like, oh, wait a minute. You know, I mean, you're okay with it, but it's not the stereotype that people have in their minds, you know.
I think that's exactly right, and that's why I don't really lament it so much. But I think for me, it's interesting to figure out what are the unique kind of elements in magic about that sort of gender difference. And I think, you know, for me, especially in mentalism, there is something really interesting about a woman being able to have the kind of social power that magic gives you when you're performing, you know, because that is the case, you know, are this kind of powerful character.
Sure.
And I think having a woman in that sort of position that she can kind of get your, you know, seemingly get your real thoughts and your real feelings is terrifying, and can be terrifying a slightly different way. For men, you know, if a woman is doing it.
You know, another thing is, of course, the magic, obviously the bug has bitten you, and it does a lot of people. And when it does, then that lasts for a lifetime. And I'm thinking also about how that men will age and they continue to book themselves. I mean, just like, let's say, television personalities that you're aware of course, who are on the news anchor or whatever. But those who are women don't seem to have that kind of longevity, if you will, I guess, you know, in television. And I was talking with a friend of mine here, Trixie Bond, who is a children's show magician, and actually she was on the cover of Magic Magazine several years ago. Anyhow, she was saying she was having a conversation with Becky Blaney, who is Walter Zany Blaney's daughter, and then Lisa Mena. Each of them have decided, that, I think, in their own way, about how they were going to gracefully age and continue to perform. And in Becky's situation, that she has always had an upbeat, kind of an exciting thing where she has been like a cheerleader, you know, she's won Miss Texas or Miss Pickup Eating Contest or whatever. And so she got, you know, she produces these trophies and things. So she's kind of continued to try to keep this youthful image. Lisa Mena, on the other hand, has kind of taken on the position of being a bag lady, you know, this older woman, and she puts on a lot of makeup and kind of, you know, baggy clothes. So she has more pockets and a big purse, and she is more sarcastic. Whereas Trixie has decided, well, instead of wearing shorter dresses, I'll wear an evening gown, you know, and I just kind of will age gracefully and as I'm doing strolling and whatever, you know, from my purse or whatever, basically remain the age but be age appropriate as far as my dress. It's just a different perspective from three different professionals of how
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's completely relevant thought, you know, because it's exactly true. When you're in a performance art, you know, your appearance and how you come across obviously is hugely consequential. And I think for women, you're exactly right. I mean, they age out of television very quickly. I mean, I think for me, luckily, the way that I perform, I mean, my sort of mentalism character, as it were, is, you know, I base my performing around ideas, and my character is you know, myself, but someone who just doesn't really understand where these powers are coming from, but is kind of still working with them and still trying to figure things out. So it's very much this interpersonal, you know, I never dress in, I don't have a costume as such, yeah. You know, for performing. I'm very much just, you know, trying to kind of integrate these things into normal life. So I tend to perform at small dinner parties and things.
Yeah, it's fascinating, if you don't mind me exploring this further, because, you know, Bob Cassidy and others have had discussions with me on the podcast in the past about trying to identify what are your powers and not to,
yes.
to do everything, you know, but you should focus on something or a few things so this way that it seems more believable kind of a thing. And so it sounds like you spent a lot of time thinking about what your powers are and how you want to develop a stage character.
Exactly. I spent a huge amount of time thinking about that. I mean, even at the beginning of my kind of pathway with magic, I was thinking about that on a broader kind of scope of what's possible in magic and what that story is of what we're actually doing, and kind of thinking of what was the most powerful thing, you know, what would the most powerful story be? And I never really landed on an answer, but for me, mm-hmm. it definitely, I mean, you know, I'm sure we all have this complaint, you know, it's, you see people who perform an effect just thinking about the effect and how it works. And then you see someone who's really integrated that effect into a bigger idea or a bigger sense of who they are and what they're doing. And that to me is necessary to make magic good, you know, to make it big enough. And so for me, I definitely decided, okay, I came to the point that I'm at now, which is where I am with the audience in a sense, exploring what this power is, because mm-hmm. ultimately I wasn't comfortable pretending certain things that were kind of unbelievable. And I liked the idea of the unknown. I mean, ultimately for me, magic and mentalism is this kind of venture into the unknown. Mm-hmm. And I decided, okay, I'm going to do that with my audience and go together and sort of use this thing to guide them. And then I can leave them with questions rather than answers.
That's a very good way of looking at it. I was thinking another thing, Marcy, as far as whenever you're performing sometimes and there are some men in your audience, I'm sure from time to time, who mm-hmm. are, how would I put this? I guess they're not very confident, or maybe they're too overconfident, and they don't like to see a powerful woman on stage. And if you're
right.
able to reach inside their mind, so to speak, and to tell them not just what they're thinking, but how they're thinking, they might take an affront to that, or they may not believe it, or they might,
yep.
You know, so you can kind of turn off an audience. I'm saying, I think that is another hurdle that unfortunately a woman would have to overcome that a man wouldn't. If that makes sense.
Absolutely, it does. And I think, you know, my sort of view of my powers, as it were, mm-hmm. lets me sort of say, well, yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. You know, if somebody wants to challenge me and be confrontational, I mean, I tend to be a fairly confrontational person
okay.
back. So I've sort of guarded against that a little bit because uh-huh. I don't want to be, you know, at somebody's dinner party and start a fight, which an intellectual
not a good
battle,
thing.
Which I'm always yeah. happy to do. But so, you know, so I definitely have set it up in a way where, you know, if somebody tries to challenge something, I say, yeah, I'm not sure about that. I don't know. And,
well, sometimes it's fun to kind of explore. You know, another one of my business partners, Jamie Salinas, and I have done seances for a number of years together. And as we've been early on, when we were trying to find our own way, you know, we didn't really want to have people after the show to come over and ask us to, you know, contact their great aunt or something, you know. And so it was like more of a ghost hunters is what we decided upon as that kind of a character.
Right.
Basically, once you join
right.
us in our exploration of trying to, you know, venture into the unknown that we don't know anything about either, we're just going to open the door and see what happens, you know. And
exactly.
Yeah. And so I think if you have some sort of an adventure that you're leading your audience on, that's kind of like, hey, this is kind of fun, isn't it? I don't know how this stuff happens, but look, this actually bends in my hand whenever I touch it or something, whatever mm-hmm. it is, you know.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, magic is, you know, like all art, best used to explore ideas and
sure.
themes, you know, the same as documentary filmmaking or any other art form. So for me, it allows me to ask questions of, you know, what is it about yourself that made you answer in this way? You know, it's obviously there's a lot of kind of, you know, foundational routines in magic where you'd ask somebody to pick, you know, mm-hmm. a color or a number, whatever it is. And you can take that in infinite directions that make it an experience of exploration of either self or ideas that I think a lot of times it ends up just being an effect. But I think, you know, the challenge for me is I always think, how far can I take this? If somebody's choosing, if somebody's ending up with a blue square, you know, something right. super simple,
right.
how can I make that about an idea or a choice that's, that makes them feel like they're really exploring something about themselves? And the idea of choice, I mean, I love playing with the idea of choice and why we make certain decisions and how our mind actually works to do that. So I'm working now on integrating in a little bit more, a little bit more of like the kind of concept of free will and choice into, you know, without being too heavy handed and kind of,
right.
you know, pop science-y about it, but to kind of integrate that into my stuff, because I just find that a really easy, interesting fit.
It's also important, obviously, to touch your audience and to connect with them. And so this way that it makes it personal with them so that they can actually be emotionally invested in your show rather than just doing something cute that could be on television, kind of a thing
Definitely.
That they wouldn't be involved in. But when you're in a personal live experience, if you're actually having somebody do that, then you can really connect with your audience whenever they're holding something or that you're picking the blue square or whatever that's actually, you know, happening, you know, right there.
Yes, so exactly.
That's why I assume what you're doing is you're trying to find more ways of connecting.
Definitely. It's all for me about connecting. And that's why I really don't have aspirations to do, you know, an 18-minute show at the Magic Castle or whatever that is, because for me, I'm honestly trying to think sometimes of ways to take it even farther away from the sort of dinner party scenario where I tend to do, you know, to perform, and think of ways of, in a very natural sense, kind of taking it out of that format. Because for me, you know, in the same way that close-up magic, you know, you can show people on TV or you can show people, you know, I mean, even people in the back row, it's a totally different experience than somebody sitting at the table. Sure. So for me, you know, in the same way with mentalism, that's the goal, is that somebody has the most immediate experience with it that they can. And for me, that's part of the environment of making it feel natural, and that magic, this magic is part of the real world that we're in, not part of a performance.
Right, right, right. It happens all the time. In other words, that you just happen to have these powers, and I'm going to show you some of the things that's kind of cool, you know, kind of explore.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I'm exploring these things. I'm learning, you know, I'm learning about this. I'm learning about, like, you know, and then I can do, you know, kind of classically integrate whatever parts I want, you know, that people will know that I study magic, but I also study psychology, and I'm, you know, these are all things that are integrated mm-hmm. together. Mm-hmm. And I can, you know, go down all the nuanced pathways of all of those things.
Now, when you're performing, you had mentioned a few times about working dinner parties, but you haven't worked the castle. So I assume it's not like comedy clubs or anything. So they're just, and they're not corporate things. It sounds like they're mostly private events in people's homes.
Definitely. That's all I've done. And I really don't, I genuinely just don't know how I would even translate my act to, I rarely even call it an act, to be honest, but to a stage performance. And for me, that lets me stay, it kind of lets me stay in the parts of magic that I love the most. Mm-hmm. I mean, it mm-hmm. really, you know, I am one of those, you know, jerks who will sit in the back of, you know, a stage show. And I see things I love all the time, but I more often see things that I think, oh, you know, I get why that was kind of visually compelling, but where's the idea behind this? And what, you know, and I just want there to be more. And so mm-hmm. I don't think I know how I would, I just don't know how I would translate my, you know, my performance to a stage show. So I'm definitely just focused in on doing better with my ideas and with translating my ideas rather than expanding my performance. Because I'm also, it's not, I don't think it's ever going to be a full-time job.
Full-time,
I joke about
you.
It.
Yeah.
I want it to be sometimes internally, but I don't think externally that's
So how many people
realistic.
Do it normally at these parties? Like 20, 30 people tops? Or
no, really, honestly, like 10 or 12 people
okay.
for me is the way. And honestly, I've done things, I mean, my favorite things I've done have been, you know, when a friend has me along as a, I mean, my favorite thing is definitely when I come along as a dinner party guest, you know, they're like, look, you know, I mean, I end up usually like waiving the fee, of course, because yeah. I just love doing it. But, but a friend will give me, you know, a really small fee to like come along, be part of the dinner and then do something afterwards. And that's mm-hmm. really my favorite way of doing it, because I just, I don't know. It just lets me gather information through the
yeah.
dinner too. I mean, that's
sure.
kind of one of my favorite things is,
pre-show.
You know, yeah, definitely. It's like a very natural pre-show, and it's, you know, and one of my favorite things to do is to use like a one ahead routine, but to use something at the beginning that I kind of have sussed out from the conversation
sure.
so that I kind of, you know, trickily get this information that, I mean, I sometimes will even use a very strong guess to kind of get the first thing going.
Right.
But I really like to do that and to kind of blend methods in that way. But I just have had so, I just don't have enough. I don't have enough, I don't know, time and practice to have really pushed it. And I'm really going to, I think this is the time when I'm starting to do that a little bit more.
Well, if you don't mind me asking, I'd like to also kind of explore a little bit like when you were younger. In other words, that I would like for parents to be able to recognize certain things in their daughters or sons, that they might see that there is a spark of an interest that could generate a magician or a mentalist in their future as well. So were there things that you were interested in that may have been considered nerdy, I guess, when you were a child? I mean, like comic books or, I don't know, whatever, gaming? I don't know.
I was absolutely not into comic books or gaming, and I have a lot of friends that I think are very brilliant and are into that stuff. And I am, for whatever reason, absolutely not into that stuff. And I almost wish that I were. But I was just always into, I was always into human behavior and human, you know, interactions and psychology and the, you know, and philosophy and those kind of bigger kind of picture ideas. And I think
when you were a child,
magic
you're saying.
Yeah. Obviously, when you're a kid, it's, you know, it comes across as like storytelling or writing or whatever that is. But, and, you know, I liked making friends and meeting new people and finding out their stories and things like that. And as an adult, you know, or as a teen or whatnot, you know, that becomes a little bit more formally, you know, psychology or whatnot. But I just was always into the stories of people and how we live life. And honestly, that's still the thing that I think ties into magic for me, because magic is its own completely unique way of exploring human perspective and how much our perspective creates our world, and the fact that you can play with that, and that we're so easily tricked, you know, and that we're so easily, you know, able to see something that isn't there, or to experience a feeling that, you know, comes from the unknown. So sorry, this is, I'm dragging this out of childhood and into adulthood, but sure. I think as a kid, I was just one of those, I was definitely nerdy and I was definitely creative, but I definitely just, you know, also like to talk to people. And and I think maybe that's the opposite of some of the classic stories we hear about, you know, I mean, I know some of my friends definitely start out with that cliche sort of not, you know, sort of socially awkward childhood that came into magic. I was definitely the opposite. And
you
I
were
think
outgoing.
That, yeah, I was outgoing. And I think for a kid who's into magic, I mean, magic is just an endless playground for ways of, you know, of presenting things to people, showing people something cool, and exploring all the different ways of performing it for them. So I think, you know, those outgoing kids should be diving in there just as much if we could make that happen.
You know, some years ago, I was being interviewed for a job, and the fellow who was interviewing me was ready to hire me, but he said one thing that everybody who is being might be considered as being employed here, that we have to go through this psychological evaluation. And so I talked to a psychologist, and as I was talking with him, he was really interested about me being a magician, because he was thinking, well, you know, typically it seems like that somebody starts out, they're kind of maybe fairly quiet, and so that they are you know, what is your reason really for getting into it? Well, actually, I was kind of like then you, Marcy. I mean, I was outgoing and I was involved with sports and a lot of other activities and whatever. I really didn't get into magic until a little bit later than in life when, well, actually, I was at 8 years old, forgot about it, and it's back when I was 20 again, whenever I got bitten by the bug, you know, then again. But yes, so I was saying with the psychologist, you know, asking me about this, and I was saying, well, I like to have people think what I think. In other words, I was my undergraduate degree was in advertising and in journalism, and my minor was radio and television. And I wanted to write, direct, and produce TV commercials because I wanted people to believe what I was trying to sell. In other words, that's, you know, you, and also you have to, with advertising, as you know, you hide the things that are not your strong points and you emphasize those that are.
Right.
And so it's the same thing that magic is. So basically, as a salesman or negotiating, which was later my career for a number of years, that I was a magician, I guess, in a way, because I was trying to sell some. I mean, it was a good product, you know, what I was talking about, but the but you had to have a little bit of magic. And so I guess what I'm saying is that I you just have to have in my case, I didn't like to fool people. I liked for people to believe what I was trying to sell. In other words, I want people to believe me and to like me. And so I think that's what we as entertainers on stage really need, that applause. We need to have that laughter, you know, and that's kind of like you were saying, you know, you would do it for a reduced fee or for free. I mean, many of us are the same way. You just kind of like to do that. But many of us also have to make a living to, you know, pay the next bills or whatever then too. But anyhow, I'm getting you off on a tangent.
I agree with, you know, the thing that I can relate to with that is that I want people the most to kind of explore my ideas. I mean, that's I relate to what you're saying, especially in the sense that I think, you know, when they go away, I want people to be thinking about the same things that I'm thinking about.
Sure, there you go.
In a way, my magic sort of tricks them into doing that, or not tricks them into it, but, you know, guides them down that path where they're suddenly thinking about that. And that makes me happy.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely. Exactly. That makes me feel less alone in the world that these people are now thinking about the same sort of ideas and questions that I am.
We'll return to our conversation with Marcy Hume in just a moment, but right now I want to introduce you again to our sponsor of the Great American Magic Company, the owner, Eric Citron. Hi there, Eric.
Hi, Scott. How are you? And welcome back from Vegas, and congratulations on your win for the fourth time of the Texas Magician of the Year.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, it's a Houston Magician of the Year, which is very honorable, and I appreciate that. And it was, the fourth win. It was kind of a surprise for me then as well. So, and Las Vegas was fantastic. Everyone was just very wonderful as far as opening their homes and their dressing rooms and everything to have a chance to allow me to come in and chat with them, and they were quite open. And so I think everyone's going to be enjoying the Las Vegas Chronicles as I present them over the next few months, because I had quite a few people to talk to.
And I want to just a brief 2 cents on the documentary on the magicians. I just finished watching it the other day, and it was fantastic, and it really gave you some true insight on what it was like to be a working road warrior with some of the top names in magic. Some you may know, some you may not, but John Armstrong, Brian Gillis, really gave you some great insight. So kudos to the people that made the film. I would highly recommend it.
Good. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, that was, I thought, a very interesting film as well, to kind of give you the an inside to different variety from stage to close up and stand up and mentalism, all four. You know, it seems like that these guys that she put together a good film.
Yes, she did. I would highly recommend it.
Well, as far as the Great American Magic Company, so what's going on? You know, I often wonder whenever that you're shipping out your products, and I know that you provide next day shipping and everything. I mean, every online company will provide various types of shipping. Do you put these in boxes, styrofoam and bubble wrap, or how do you do all that?
Well, it depends. I mean, a lot of the stuff that we ship is through the United States Postal Service. We use, you know, all the padded envelopes and the bubble wrap and everything. I know, as to be the receiver of a product that's broken when you get it is very disappointing. And since we sell a lot of stuff that's non-traditional, more high-end stuff, sometimes one-of-a-kind pieces that we have been buying from people, I go out of my way to make sure that the stuff is, you know, you could drop it off the Empire State Building and it's not going to break. Because I know when you spend, you know, $1,000 on a stole watch and you get it and it's not working, it's disappointing for the customer, but it's a real hassle on our side too. So, you know, not only do you get free shipping for all orders over $79, but we also go out of our way to make sure that, you know, it's all tracked and everything like that.
Well, that brings me then, what about your return or refund policy?
I mean, obviously, if it's defective, we'll take it back. But if it's, you know, if you don't like it, you know, once a secret is known, we won't take it back. But, you know, it's a case by case basis. You know, there's a lot of competition out there in the online magic world and the brick and mortar magic world. So, you know, my goal is customer service is at a premium. I'll give you a quick example. Somebody emailed me yesterday, 10 o'clock last night, and I got right back to them. And the guy was like, you know, it's a 3-day weekend. You got back to me right away. You guys are fantastic. You know, there was a hiccup on the order. It wasn't my fault, but I wanted to make it right for him. So, you know, I gave him a $10 credit towards a future order. And, you know, that's my goal, is to make sure that, you know, there are a lot of choices out there. All the prices are relatively the same. And I want to make sure that we treat our customers right.
Comes down to customer service, doesn't it?
100%, because, you know, especially when you buy Murphy's is the largest, you know, magic retailer in the country or in the world.
Wholesaler.
So, and they dictate the prices. So it all comes down to service.
That's true. And so everything that you are offering and talking about, again, is the kind of thing that people want to hear, certainly, so that way they feel comfortable. And again, you say that anything over $79 is free shipping, and then if they might as well buy a little bit more, because over $100, you get $15 off.
Exactly, for all your wonderful listeners from the Magic Word Podcast, and your credentials just keep getting better and better. So, I can't wait to hear the Las Vegas Chronicles. I followed you on Facebook and saw all your interviews, and it's I'm sure every one of them is going to be very exciting, like you sitting with that person at the table, like as always.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, good luck, and I hope that everybody goes over and checks out the rewards program and everything else that you've got going over at the Great American Magic Company.com. So thank you, Eric, and let's return now to the rest of our chat with Marcy Hume. Well, it sounds also that was a natural progression for you really to get into documentaries, because as you were exploring people's lives and just like to have those open conversations about their lives and what's going on, that it sounds like you've always had an inquisitive mind, which naturally led to documentaries as opposed to other kinds of films where there are scripted.
Definitely. I mean, I started out in off-Broadway theater, and then I did journalism for a little while, and then in my 20s, eventually I found documentaries. I was living in the UK and started at the BBC and sort of bludgeoned my way into the BBC and forced them to give me jobs there. But yeah, I mean, documentary was not something. I always loved documentaries when I was younger, but I never imagined it was something I could do. And then I realized, yeah, in my sort of late mid-20s that was exactly the right thing for me. And I was old enough at that point to know, holy cow, this is exactly what I should be doing. And I sort of, tried to change from my sort of, I won't even call it a journalism career. I was sort of a fledgling journalism career into mm-hmm. doing that. And it's really been, and then everything sort of took off from there for me because I loved it so much. And I just... It's been definitely the right thing for me.
And the Magicians documentary that is being released now, that was your second one, is that correct? You said
it's my second feature. Yeah, I mean, I've worked in television now for I think 11 years, and so I've done a lot of TV series, and in the UK we only call them documentary TV series. So I've done lots of, and they even call them films over there sometimes. So mm-hmm. I've done lots of projects, but independent documentary features are definitely their own very difficult thing. And so, this is my second one. I released one in 2011.
I assume that you learned a lot from the first, so this way that you incorporate a lot of the ideas and things in the second one, because it was beautifully filmed.
Oh, thank you very much. I think so. I mean, I think, the business of independent documentary is probably similar to that of magic. You have to just be willing to keep it going no matter what. And that was the big thing for this film. We didn't have financing for it. We did a small Kickstarter campaign that got us,
In the credits, it had so many people's names listed in Kickstarter. I thought that was brilliant. I've had people who have contacted me just as an investor to say, hey, we've got a film and we're looking for some people to help pay to produce this thing. Mm. You want to invest in it. But the Kickstarter is something, of course, and GoFundMe's have been recent crowdfunding things over the last few years. And so I'm guessing more things are being done that way. Are you seeing more documentaries being funded by Kickstarter?
They are, and I've talked to a lot of my friends who work at Sundance Labs and who kind of study this stuff, and apparently uh-huh. it's already kind of on the way out again whatever reason. Yeah, I think it's a really hard thing to do. I mean, I really struggled with it in the sense that, you think it is a great format because you tell people, I'm doing this creative pursuit and you can help us and be a part of it, and we'll give you a little treat in the mail and, mm-hmm. If you donate some money to the project. And these are mostly people who have no idea what it is to make a documentary film. So then for the next, as you're struggling to get this thing done, to raise the rest of the money, to edit it, you're getting messages from people who are like, what the heck is going on? Where is this film? And you end up sort of trying to explain the filmmaking process to a bunch of people who really probably don't want to hear about it. Yeah, right. They were just like, well, I just gave you, $50 and I just want to see the film. That's all. I don't want to hear about
How much were you trying to raise to begin with, and how much did you raise?
Well, we put down 30,000 as our goal, and we ended up raising 45, which is great. Yeah. So after fees and stuff, you get about 40. So that covered for us some assistant editors putting the, you know, organizing all the footage, you know, transcoding it and syncing it, you know, cutting it down and marking it. And then I think that after that, we had about 6 weeks of an editor, you know, an editor, a good doc editor is $3,000 a week or whatnot. So we got somebody to work for less than that for us. But so that's where the, you know, the Kickstarter money was used very well, but gone fairly quickly with that. And then we had to find other ways to keep editing. So
the whole film cost a lot more than that. I mean, there were a lot of other producers.
Yeah.
I mean, when I hear that,
well,
no
producers got paid, but we definitely had to spend money on it's editing, you know, all of post-production is incredibly expensive. I mean, we shot the film ourselves, with gear that we had. So we, for the most part, you know, there are expenses while you're filming, obviously travel and everything, but we were happy to cover that. It's really when it gets to post for an editor working for a year and a half. And then, you know, the final sound mix and color and all of that is incredibly expensive. So we, oh boy, Scott, we just made it happen. I can't even, I could tell you forever about the details, but it's
you just kept pushing through. It's going to happen.
We basically just made it. And I was working full time in television. So thankfully I had a regular paycheck coming in from that, which was very helpful.
Right. Well, now how
to keep it going.
How long of a period of time was the filming? I mean, I know the post usually takes about a year to 2 years, but it looked like that this documentary took place over at least a 12-month period.
Oh, yeah. We filmed for 4 years, actually.
Oh, 4 years. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So we started filming in 2011. We weren't really sure who was going to be in the film. And then, you know, things started happening in the lives of some of the people we were filming that made it kind of clear, you know, that there were really interesting stories playing out that we wanted to be in the film. And then we just kept filming. There was a lot of time when nothing happened and we filmed a bunch of stuff. And it was just, you know, we would film gigs and scenes and people's lives that didn't really play into greater themes or stories of the film. So we just had a lot of footage that, you know,
a lot of film on the cutting room floor there.
Of
course, that's the way that it goes. But I guess one big question is, how did you decide upon the four guys? And also, just so everybody knows, if you want to mention the four people who were involved, and then I want to find out how did you decide upon those four.
Sure, absolutely. Can I answer those as we go then?
Yes.
So Jan Roof is in our film, which has been a very traumatic thing towards the end here. But we actually found him just because we knew somebody in Germany who knew him and said that he was kind of, we were looking for a stage illusionist to include. And I didn't want to include him because I thought he was, you know, pretty cheesy in his performance. But once we filmed with them, we realized they were incredibly funny, Jan and Frank. So we kind of had them as a little bit of a comic relief in the film. Mm-hmm. Then David Minkin, I'd been chatting with at the castle for a couple of years at that point. So I didn't really have an intention of including him, but I knew him well enough that it was, you know, when we started filming, we just thought, well, we should film David because we know him and he's here and whatever. And, and that just sort of evolved. I mean, he had a very clear goal of getting a TV show, which was fairly interesting for us to pursue.
It was.
Brian Gillis, I also wasn't intending on putting in the film. Brian Tolman at the Magic Castle, he's a board member at the castle, had suggested a bunch of people to me. And Brian Gillis was one of them. We went to his castle to film. And that moment happened that's in his first scene in the movie where the dogs jump up on the bed as we're interviewing him. And we were just in love with that moment. I mean, as it was happening, Christoph and I were just stock still, just trying to like not move or laugh because we just loved it as a documentary moment. And we thought, well, let's go film him one more time and see if he's, you know, worth it. And
I like that from the standpoint that he was talking about Susafan leaving and they were separated. And so it's kind of like, you know, his bed was empty, but then now he's sharing it with his dogs. I know what you mean. It's like, that was perfect.
Exactly.
That was really so cool.
I love that too. Exactly. That's a great view on it. But then the second time we went to film, we thought, okay, let's just go film him one more time. And we showed up to the castle and he said, oh, you have to actually come around the corner because I moved. And he'd moved into this, you know, this tiny place. And we were both like, oh my God, this just illustrates so perfectly, you know, the kind of art versus commerce aspect of magic. You know, it's like, it just was such a compelling moment. So that sort of sealed the deal with him. And then John Armstrong is a final character. And I met him at the castle. And he was just so, you know, I don't know if anybody knows John. You know, I first met him, he was like, hi, I'm John Armstrong. He was very kind of pretentious and kind of had this wall. And I was like, oh, hell no, I am not putting this guy in a movie because he thinks he's very special and I'm not going to make him feel more special. This is not happening. And then like half an hour later, I'd seen his show that night. Half an hour later, I was like, oh, God, I have to put this guy in the film because he's so... like clearly has built these walls and clearly has this way of trying to come across, but there's obviously way that means there's so much under the surface. And I was like, damn it, I have to put this guy in the movie. So he's still, I mean, that I still think he's the kind of person that you could make a full feature documentary about.
It was interesting whenever I was watching the film also about the lecture tour that ended up, you know, being the thing that kind of caused his divorce, being away and everything. And I was not aware that that was the timing that that happened, because I was one who had booked that tour for him across the states.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
I recall also that he was going down into Mexico. He was going down into Chihuahua and that way, and so I'd helped him, you know, he got the train to go down there and everything. But, yeah, I had booked all of his places for his
Oh,
his
wow.
Tour.
That's fascinating. Well, I do think it was a complicated, you know, mix of factors for sure. So I wouldn't take it upon tour as a blame. But
it was one of those things, and I don't know if you cut it this way or it just happened whenever that they were at the wedding and the documentary, and as he was talking and saying, you know, I'm so much in love, or I'm having, you know, he was the one, and then she said, yeah, it's okay. Or something, you know.
Yeah,
she just wasn't didn't seem to be as into it, and he was one who liked the idea of being married, and she didn't. It sounded like from the very get go, you know.
So I
thought, this is not destined for anything. I mean, I knew the outcome anyhow, but
Of course, and I think it's, you know, when you're cutting something like that, you don't want it to feel obvious that, you know, that is where this is headed. I mean, I think, you know, we tried to cut both the, you know, the wedding in a way that it didn't feel like you know exactly what's going to happen, because I think there would have certainly been a way of cutting it where you just feel like, oh, no, this
now,
is doomed.
But, there were the four gentlemen who were in there, and as we've talked the first half over here about you being a woman, had you considered having a woman being involved?
I did, definitely. I mean, I'm really fascinated by Kristen Lambert. I think she is kind of, in the way that John Armstrong is, she's very kind of, you know, composed and pulled together in this kind of performative way, which makes me very, you know, curious about, you know, she clearly has a lot of kind of depth of and intelligence, you know, under that, but a very kind of composed exterior that I always find kind of fascinating. And as a person and as a documentarian, I want to crack, definitely. But, you know, she'd already been in Clay Tuile's film, Make Believe, and I just thought, you know, we can't do that.
Well, Suzanne would be another one, good one.
Suzanne would have been great. I had, or my one of my producers had a little chat with her, and I can't remember why we didn't. There's a specific reason why we thought she wasn't going to be a great fit. And then there were a couple of other folks that we talked about, but honestly, by the time we got, you know, we just had such a list of people to chat with, and there were a couple of women on there, but it wasn't, I didn't make a big effort of like, we've got to include a woman and I've got to talk to, you know, every woman magician. I just didn't, it wasn't a concern for me in the way that, honestly, I mean, I enjoy talking about it, but it's not a concern for me that there aren't a lot of women in magic.
Right. Well,
you know, I don't really care.
I would imagine also that as this became more well known, that was what you were doing, were soliciting magicians for this documentary and a feature film, that you must have had people coming out of the walls. Hey, you need to use me, or here, you know, let me send you my information or whatever.
A little bit. Yeah. But I think, you know, for whatever reason, we didn't have a huge amount of that. I mean, a little bit for sure. But I also, it sort of doesn't matter at that point, because you know so quickly when you talk with someone. You know, I chatted with anybody who was kind of around and wanted to chat, but you know so quickly who could be a compelling documentary character. I mean, in a way, anybody can, right? Like, you can make people compelling on film, but I think for what we're looking for and sustaining, you know, feature, there were certain things we were kind of looking for and sensing, you know, over the years of practice, you start kind of sensing how that might work.
Now, when you're setting up the documentary also, is any of it actually scripted, or are you saying, hey, wait a minute, can we recapture that again, or try to reshoot something, or do you, I mean, it's hard to capture that lightning in a bottle once it's gone, though.
Yeah, it's definitely not scripted at all. I mean, we didn't, you know, the only things that we do are we get shots of people, you know, it's hard to get the full scene. If you want to get somebody walking in, often we'll be like, give us 2 minutes, please. We're going to go set up.
Right.
And, you know, before they come in, or little insert shots or whatnot. But no, we never said, like, hey, can you go say this to this person? Or
it's not like reality TV kind of a thing where that
And I make reality TV, and I'm a big proponent of the fact that we need more terminology in reality TV, because there are definitely shows that are more kind of fully scripted in reality, mm-hmm. and there's some that are absolutely completely nothing is produced. So mm-hmm. yeah, and mm-hmm. so it's really hard that we have this term reality TV, but you know, yeah, there's obviously times that we, you know, produce things in reality, and we didn't want to do that with
now,
this one.
When you were putting this together, since it wasn't scripted or anything, did you, and you started talking with these people, you kind of explained how each of those four guys, you know, they became more interesting, you decided to follow it, and there were times in which you were filming and really nothing else was happening. Did you follow them for like a month or a week at a time, or make schedule and say, hey, you got some shows coming up, or can I follow you or do this or that, or when you're traveling, how did you decide that, or what kind of an agenda did you have?
We just tried to keep an eye on what they were doing. I mean, we always ask subjects to call us when things are happening and, uh-huh. and tell us what they're up to, and we can decide if we want to go or not to film something. And usually we do go, just especially at the beginning, because you just don't know what's going to happen. It's basically about kind of bugging them a lot to kind of be around, you know, and say, and if you don't hear from them, you kind of say like, hey, what's happening this week? It's hard to, I mean, you don't want to generate a crazy amount of footage. You know, I think we try and stick with as much as we can, but we definitely had to pick and choose. You know, if there's a gig in Malibu and you think, well, what are we going to get out of this? Well, we don't know, but let's mm-hmm. just hedge our bets and assume that we're not going to spend a night driving out to Malibu and shooting another performance. So, and then there are themes with each character that you start to see emerge, you know, yeah. I mean, I definitely with John from the beginning was pretty fascinated with, you know, the idea of kind of control and him sort of like controlling the social dynamic and his performances, but how that kind of bleeds into life and all that kind of stuff. So you sort of look for moments that are going to sort of illuminate more depth of the things that you're already interested in about a person.
Well, I found them so real in all the things that they've done. I mean, it was for an example, like whenever that Brian Gillis and Susan Fan were backstage and she had missed a word. My wife and I have done two person mind reading act, and that she says, look, I can only read what you're sending me. And then you send me the wrong word, you know? And so we've been backstage and had those kinds of arguments. It was kind of funny, you know?
I love, there are a lot of moments in the film that work to me as a, to steal a sort of cheesy mentalism term, a sort of dual reality with magicians mm-hmm. and the normals, because you know, that moment I love, she's saying, well, why would she's kind of basically trying to say,
I was close.
And he's saying, but you have to say the word, and it has to be
jackhammer, not smash.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a lot of moments like that. There's a little moment in his lecture where he's talking about a method that I was so careful with audiences, everything sure. that was method related. Right. I kind of showed to audiences and said, what do you take from this? And made sure that nothing read. So there are little moments that are kind of mm-hmm. for magicians mean one thing, and for the regulars mean right. something else.
So again, part of my question was if you had an agenda. I mean, in other words, that's the problem with documentaries. You don't know where it's going to be going, because sometimes you could film that and you, after a couple of years or 4 years, it's like, you know, this real, I don't think you might want to come and see this, you know, but did you have an agenda saying, I think this is really something that's going to take?
You know, we didn't have an agenda as such. We just, for the first year or two, we really just said, we're just going to keep filming. And at that mm-hmm. point, you know, themes and you start, you know, actually we started editing after a couple of years. So let's say in year three, you start getting rough cuts of scenes together and you start kind of seeing what some of the themes might be that emerge. You know, you kind of have ideas in your head about what's interesting about people, but you know, lots of things start emerging. And then when you go shoot more, you sort of, you know, have in mind, oh, we want to see an ending to this moment, or we want to have something that kind of wraps up this moment. So, right. So you start kind of crafting it in that way, but not an agenda as like, we have to get a scene where we have John in a hotel room bed. You know, that like right. that as one of my favorite moments in the film was just that, you know, we went with him on this gig, came home, he was lying down, we set up the camera and I just started talking with him. And, you know, so you just get these moments that, you know, you decide in the moment when
very
you're
genuine.
Gonna roll. And
I
love that moment.
Yeah. Those kinds of things I feel like, well, yeah, I'm just right there. I mean, I could imagine, you know, many times when you've been sessioning or just sitting in someone's room and they're, you know, laying there talking or whatever, you know, like that then too. Another thing is that obviously that was when John had all of his weight, and since then that he has slimmed down tremendously. And so my question is that I was expecting, like, at the end, maybe to show a before and after picture. In other words, that I understand this had been filmed, you know, for a period of 4 years, and then you took about 18 months to cut it, and it was had a 2016 date on it. So when people are seeing this now in 17, they might be expecting something completely different, saying, wow, John sure was big, you know, back then, because they know and have seen him now, because he's been in his new suit, I guess, for at least a couple of years, I think. You know,
yeah.
So I thought there might be something at the end of saying, you know, that, or here's what John's doing now, you know, as far as performing or whatever.
Yeah, we thought, you know, after the Hot Docs Film Festival, which was, you know, our kind of festival premiere and a time for us to really talk about the film with, you know, all of the film industry folks that we needed to kind of discuss it with. We thought about whether or not we wanted to do these kind of updates at the end, and the consensus was among the kind of doc community, and I kind of felt this way too, is that, you know, we left people with this feeling from the film, you know, this last kind of light bulb moment of this penny, mm-hmm. you know, penetrating the light bulb. And it just, right. you know, when we kind of walked through it once and kind of threw them up on screen, it was just so kind of took that feeling away. It was so kind of pedantic and like, mm-hmm. and now, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, it just felt really staid and empty. So we just decided not to do it. And I think, you know, I don't know. That's just where we landed. I totally can see a version where we did that, and I get why that would be intriguing, but
yeah,
we just,
you know,
made the call not to.
Sometimes in real or films are saying, you know, here's where the person is today, or here's what happened, you know, later. I mean, whenever it's a film that's supposed to be from real life or something from World War II or whatever, you know, here's what the people are doing now. And in particular, I want to talk about, I guess, for just a moment, about Jan Reuben, obviously, because of him being in Vegas. I mean, that's the story to me at the end. It's kind of like, wow, you know, that he no longer has the show. And I'm not sure if he's in jail or what. I understand he's still in Vegas, but, you know.
Yeah. Well, and we
were there attorney problems
have been
with
trying
that?
To no. I mean, it was, you know, the film was, you know, all wrapped up by the time that happened. And what we did decide to do was we did continue to try and film with him, because we decided, well, it's not going to make it into this film. You know, there'd be no way. I mean, we certainly didn't have the resources to, like, stop the release and then, like, reshoot and mm-hmm. recut an entirely new film. That just wasn't,
sure.
you know, and if you've seen the film, you can see how sharp of a turn that would be, and, you know,
wow.
it would be so tough to include. So we didn't have the resources to do that. So it was either kind of release the film or don't release the film. And, you know, we decided everybody was behind us in releasing the film. But mm-hmm. we did decide to continue filming and tried to get permission to kind of follow the story, because we just thought, oh my God, we have no idea where this is going. You know, he, you know, I mean, I don't know what his view is now, but at the beginning it seemed like they were, you know, going to do everything they could to fight it. So it seems like an interesting story to follow. We haven't had a huge amount of luck with that yet, but, you know.
You mean you haven't been shooting any of it?
No, we haven't been able to film anything yet, mm-hmm. but I would still like to. I mean, we still talk about it. We think if we can get in there and, you know, and film something. I don't know what it would be, but often in documentary, it's just that whole thing of like, well, if you don't shoot it, if you miss it, then you don't have it and you can't go back and shoot it again. So we figured, well, we might as well get whatever we can on tape now. And then if nothing happens with it, nothing happens
that's
with
right.
it.
Well,
least
that's
what we
I was,
have it.
That's exactly what I was thinking. For an example, you know, that David Kay had the movie that was made about his family, you know, and I think the original documentarian that had been following him just kind of being Silly Billy in New York City, basically. And,
right.
And then he was talking about his family, and then one thing kind of led to another, and it got real dark real quick. And then
yep.
they said, wow, here's the direction we weren't planning, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And
definitely.
So it's the same thing. I think that could be a whole documentary if you got some stuff that can be picked up from the cutting room floor, you know, to make one about Jan.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard because the stuff that we filmed wouldn't really fit with that in any way because it was so funny, you know, but I
sure.
think starting from, but you never know. You could certainly feed things. And I think it's an interesting story, you know, as I said, I mean, we, you know, the idea of following it is definitely intriguing. So it's one of those things that's kind of always on the list, you know, it's like, well, let's wait and see how things play out and see if and when we can get in there to film a little bit more. And then mm-hmm. who knows what that will turn into.
And so from this point forward, you're going to be releasing it. What is your schedule as far as distribution?
Well, it's out now. So we got distribution. We went to the Hot Docs Film Festival and we got distribution with a company called Gravitas Ventures, who are really great. And they distribute a lot of documentaries. So they released the film in, let's see, the release date was like last November, mid-November. So we had a release on all digital platforms. So it's on iTunes and Amazon and every digital platform you can think of. So your cable, video on demand system, Google Play, Vudu, all these places yeah. that I still haven't used. And then we have obviously DVDs on Amazon mm-hmm. that people can order. We also got a global Netflix deal, which is really great.
Wow,
and something that we really wanted and that came through for us, that Gravitas did the deal for us. So as of later this month, it's going to be, I think February 13th, it's going to be on Netflix globally. So that's really great because it means that people in, you know, way more countries than just the U.S. and Canada can see the film.
So you won't have to purchase this necessarily on iTunes unless you want to have a copy of your own that you can download. It'll be available through Netflix if you have a subscription.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't know how long it will be available there. But yeah, I would say if somebody wants to own the film or buy the DVD, it would be great. And also it will support the filmmakers because our hope is just to recoup our expenses. That's all we're hoping for here.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You know, I've talked with other people who have done some other films, independent films like that, that, yeah, it's just being done on a string and a prayer, basically, it seems mm-hmm. like, you know, and it's like calling on all their friends. Can you help me out with this and that? So,
yeah,
filmmakers are just not, unless they get to a certain level, I guess, they really don't make any money. I mean, not just a little bit of money, but no money. I mean,
Oh, definitely. We paid to make the documentary for sure, and that's why we want to recoup expenses.
Sure.
And I do hope, you know, as things grow, I mean, I have a new producer for my the next film or one of the next films I'm working on. And I do hope that this, you know, Magicians has done really well, thankfully. And so I think it will hopefully the next film I won't have to hustle as hard and I will have some financing behind it. But, I would have done whatever it took to make this
film.
Well,
you'll have
some
good credits.
I loved it, so.
Yeah, have some good credits behind your name then, of course. And now, do you have something in mind you're going to be doing next time? And I assume it has nothing to do with Magicians.
That's right. It has nothing to do with Magicians, and I can't believe how cheesy this sounds, but I can't quite say what it is yet. But it's
I understand.
I don't mean that in a dramatic Hollywood sounding way. I just can't quite yet. But I will, of course, shout it from the rooftops as soon as I can announce it because it's a really fun one. And yes, it's. I would love to make my hope is that in 10 or 20 years, I can somehow make a different film about magic. That, you know, when I set out to make this film, I really did want to make it about. A little bit more on the nose about magic and kind of its power and the kind of psychological power behind it and what it can tell us about our perspective. And it ended up being about making a living in magic, which I love too, but there's still a lot more to explore.
I agree completely. For an example, like working in trade shows and different kinds of things about how that you can move people and how you can sell things and you can, again, use magic for certain kinds of things. There's a whole different angle over there because this and following the lives of magicians and for those who want to see kind of the behind the scenes and what's happening, it almost seemed kind of sad, you know, kind of at the end, particularly, you know, where people, their lives didn't work out and because they're pursuing magic and this is really the passion and I'm willing to you know, have the ups and downs and make a lot of money or make zero money or owe money or whatever that I just want to continue to do this. And I think that's just the life of an artist. I don't care if it's going to be a magician artist or if you're going to be a dancer. You know, there are people, I'm sure you can follow the same kinds of story, I would imagine, in New York City or people who are trying to get on Broadway and, you know, and going to auditions or actors or whatever, any other kind of artist. I think they would have a similar kind of stories that you have. But, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it was almost sad, you know, in some of the ways that it turned out, because it's like you're really rooting and hoping the person is going to be like the next David Copperfield on his own island or something, you know.
I completely agree. It is, and that's what I love about the film the most, I think, is that, you know, if for people who have never really thought about magic, you know, they see what it is to be a magician, but I think, you know, more impactfully, you kind of experience what it is to be an artist, and it gives you, I hope, kind of more empathy and interest in those lives around you of people that are just hell-bent on making a living mm-hmm. at this thing that they love so much. And there's so much of that going on around us. And, you know, I love that that's happening sort of invisibly mm-hmm. everywhere, you know, because being passionate about something like that is the best we can hope for in life,
right.
I think.
Right. And that shows the passion. That was probably the main thing that came through was passion. For what they were doing, and it didn't matter if they were going to continue for the rest of their lives. So, Yeah, well, that sounds great. I'm glad. Well, listen, I wish you the best of luck, and it particularly sounds fantastic, you know, here for those people who, again, all of us who have Netflix, to be able to have access to that then as well. And also, I would encourage people to go out and actually to support this and to buy a copy. It's this way that try to help, you know, fund you back.
Yes, again, please. Or, you know, people can leave us little, you know, if they have nice things to say about the film, leaving reviews on Amazon and iTunes is very nice, and anything like that helps too. So,
well, that's why I was going to say, where can people go if they want to help sponsor or to order something or to leave those comments? What do they need to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, going to our website is probably the easiest. It's just magiciansmovie.com. And that has links to everything there, iTunes, Amazon. Okay. And yeah, I mean, at this point, I think, you know, grabbing a DVD or leaving a review, if they would like to support us, we would really appreciate that very much.
Yeah, it would certainly make a great Christmas gift, but don't wait until Christmas. It'd be birthday or whatever. Buy one.
Hey, there it is. There it is. I like it.
Hey, the name of my podcast, as you know, is called The Magic Word Podcast, and I always end by asking my guests what it is that's your phrase or your word. What is it that's your mantra or chi? What is it you live by, your philosophy? What is your magic word words?
Wow. That's so great. I don't know how I would pick one, but I think – I mean, I certainly don't have a phrase that's already prepared that I live by,
sure.
I think for me, it's definitely just about doing everything you can to remain passionate about your work and not letting the world get in the way.
Wow, I like that. Yeah, follow your passion. Don't let the world get in the way, because, yeah, I like that a lot. Well, Marcy Hume, I appreciate it very much, and congratulations on the successful film, and also to your co-director as well.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm so glad that I got to chat with you.
Yep. It is my pleasure as well. And so, for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Marcy Hume, and this is Scotty out. Well, another great and enlightening chat that we had here with Marcy Hume, and I want to thank her for being my guest this week and also for inspiring us with the commitment and the passion that she has for her art and documenting people's lives and for the filmmaking that she does, and also for all those who were in the film, The Magicians. So I think this is a good time for you to go over to magiciansmovie.com and help support her. Of course, you can watch that on Netflix, and you're already paying Netflix, and so they're getting some piece of that, but I would recommend that you actually go and donate, perhaps buy a DVD or in some way see how that you can help support filmmakers such as her, so this way that they can continue to make great films that will enrich our lives every day with the kinds of education and with passion that you see from other people. And so I was inspired when I watched the movie as to how these guys won't let anything get in their way. And I think that's probably a good way for us to wrap this up this week. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and be passionate about your work. And don't let the world get in your way. This is Scotty out.